Masada is a steep, rocky height deep in the Judean wilderness. Masada was among the uninhabited places of the world until in the first century before the Common Era, King Herod of Judea determined to build there an impregnable fortress. He cut a defile up the cliff out of the living rock. He barricaded the place with all manner of ingenious defense. He saw to it that it was well provisioned and well constructed. If fate and politics turned against him, this would be his place of ultimate refuge. And indeed, Masada was, for that day and age, altogether beyond assault. Now, King Herod never had to use Masada as a refuge, but others did. 1900 years ago, less two, our fathers rose in a noble but foredoomed rebellion against the iron boot of Roman dictatorship. They gave a staunch accounting of themselves, but in real life, David does not always level Goliath. And though to their surprise, the Romans three times had to summon reinforcements, and the emperor himself had to come to the scene. By the year 70 of the Common Era, the walls of Jerusalem had been breached, the city had been fired, and the temple itself had been plowed into the dust. The rebellion was at an end, except for a few hundred desperate zealots who fled into the wilderness and protected themselves behind the walls of Masada. Here they held out for 1 year and then a second. Finally, the Roman emperor had to commit a whole legion of his troops to the siege of Masada, 10,000 men against a few hundred. The siege lasted into a third year. The ruins of the Roman legionnaire square can still be seen etched into the desert floor. Finally, the carefully engineered siege machinery of the Romans reduced the outer walls of Masada. Provisions ran low, numbers were weakened. One morning, the Roman camp awoke, and no sound was to be heard from within the walls. No soldier was seen upon the walls. A scouting party was sent out. They entered Masada, and they found there death. The last defenders of Masada had compacted suicide. Two women and three little children were all who survived. Masada passed into the legend of Jewish heroics. The men of Masada became the men of iron will, the invulnerable. Masada returned to its original emptiness until 2 years ago, when a squad of scholars and research people under the leadership of the general and archaeologist Yigael Yadin determined to uncover what could be learned of the history of the place. They cleaned the approaches of debris. They put stone on stone until the walls of Herod's palace stood again. And they found underneath the char of the Roman fire all manner of provision, of coin, of battle implement which had been left there so many hundreds of years ago. All this was to be expected. What was unexpected was the quantity of writing found at Masada, not only personal letters and contracts, but any number of fragments of biblical scrolls, some of the literature of the Dead Sea Covenant people, and most wondrously of all, a complete codex of the Hebrew original of the book, The Wisdom of Ben Sirach. Joshua Ben Sirach had been a reflective and intelligent merchant prince in Jerusalem during the second century before the Common Era. He had set down for his sons and for their families his own private, intimate philosophy. The rabbis had not seen fit to add this book to the canon of the Bible. And so it had suffered over the centuries. All that we had of it until recent times was a Greek translation. And then some 40 years ago, Professor Solomon Schechter discovered in a Cairo storeroom in the Geniza a Hebrew fragment, part of the original. And now, last year, wondrously, we came in possession of the original whole, and scholars will be able to mine it for every subtlety and refinement of the original meaning. But I speak to you of the wisdom of Ben Sirach, not out of any sense of the academic achievement and treasure which has been uncovered, but for what the book tells of the men of Masada. We tend to think of the men of Masada as one-dimensioned, as men of iron, men of the sword, and men of the bow. It's hard to think of them as men of doubt, men who puzzled their fate, men who looked out at the wilderness heavens and at the sunset and who wondered why they were here, why they were faced by death, what would happen to them when they die. For the wisdom of Ben Sirach is a book which is a very honest book. It asks why and what, wherefore. Why are we here? What is demanded of us? Where are we going? And why? Most of us seem to think that our doubts, our confusions, our puzzlements about life are somehow unmanly, unworthy of us. We see the efficient dispatch by which other people lead their lives. We do not see the strength of will that this demands. And we become somewhat tortured and ashamed of our own uncertainties and tentativeness. We see the men of Masada in all men, the men of armor, the strong-willed. We do not see the men of Masada crouching beside their pitiful campfire, head buried in hand, wondering, doubting, searching. Yet the men of Masada needed to ask the basic questions, the ultimate questions, the same way that we do. They too had an inner man, a vulnerable self, as do all who walk at the edge of darkness, and we all walk there, the edge of loneliness and of uncertainty, seeing the days passing by, wondering why we are here, where are we going, whether what we are doing is meaningful or not. The men of Masada turn to the wisdom of Ben Sirach, to this honest book of introspection and reflection, and they found there, echoed and mirrored, some of their own doubts, some of their own outreachings, and all of their own search. And so we too turn time and again to some of that honest literature in which men put aside the mask of status, of confident achievement, and speak to us straight out of their private doubts and of their private philosophy. And recently, there was added to this intimate literature the reflections of one of the fine public servants of our day, the former Secretary General of the United Nations, Mr. Dag Hammarskjöld. His little slender volume's markings is by way of a series of disjointed jottings as he too stumbled along and reached out and sought to understand. And in this book, which speaks not one word of his public service, of the great and the near great among whom he lived, but only of himself, of his reactions, of his needs, of his search, we find again underscored the universal truth that beside each of us, within each of us, there is a vulnerable self, an uncertainty, a tentativeness, which we mask but cannot deny. Dag Hammarskjöld was by way of being the symbol of composure and serenity, the perfect diplomat who never dropped the mask of his composure, who walked disciplined, alert, briskly efficient. Yet we find him in this book, wondering, puzzling, stumbling along, doubting, always asking, why? Why was I born? Why will I die? What will I do? What will I accomplish in between? You may recall some years ago that Premier Khrushchev came to the United Nations and that famous shoe-banging incident that only displayed his venom and his vitriol and his lack of decency, but leveled a personal and vulgar attack at Mr. Hammarskjöld, the Secretary General. Though there is no reflection directly of this personal denunciation in the markings, that same year, Mr. Hammarskjöld wrote, "The men of the hour, the self-assured who strut among us in the jingling harness of their success and importance, how can you let yourself be irritated by them? Let them enjoy their triumph on the level to which it belongs." Dag Hammarskjöld was obviously irritated by the jingling harness of Mr. Khrushchev's success. And he turned to his diary, to his philosophy, to what he had wrenched out of the living experience, that is life, to find again the composure, the calm, which his blood and his emotions rebelled against. That the mask of composure never slipped from his face is a tribute to the strength of his will and to the quality of his person, not to the coldness of his blood. His blood was like our own, capable of anger and exasperation, knowing the full gamut and range of human emotion. But he was disciplined by a grand and noble faith, dedicated to a grand and noble purpose, and this discipline scourged him. He returned to it time and again and found there the will to hold himself in and to remain calm and proud. How we wish, most of us, that we had a similar composure. We are never proud of ourselves when we bite and we scratch back, when we forget for the moment our ultimate goal, we give vent to all of our bitterness and our anger. We are ashamed of ourselves and ashamed of having added to the sum total of human misfortune and human unhappiness. Where then can we find the strength that was Mr. Hammarskjöld? Hammarskjöld includes in the markings a little prayer which might well be our own. Pray that your loneliness may spur you into finding something to live for, great enough to die for. Pray that your loneliness may spur you into finding something to live for, great enough to die for. Somehow in his life, Mr. Hammarskjöld had found the vision splendid, the goal which keeps us on, which ennobles us by our very search, our very dedication to us. But where shall we find that something to live for? Where shall we find it? Within ourselves. How shall we find it? First off, if we follow Mr. Hammarskjöld's example, and his example is a good one, by looking at life square on, acknowledging life to be as it is. You know, you and I spend a good deal of time denying the ugliness it is about, trying to close our ears to stop up our hearing from those thoughts which we do not want to hear, denying that the questions which roil within, the questions which cannot be denied. We would prefer, if we could, to live on the surface of things and not to be bothered by the basic and the fundamental, by the brevity of life and by our own mortality. Mr. Hammarskjöld makes this fine literary analogy. Sun and stillness. Looking down through the jade and green water, you see the monsters of the deep playing on the reef. Is this a reason to be afraid? Do you feel safer when scudding waves hide what lies beneath the surface? And of course, we do feel safer when the sun shimmers off the surface of life and we do not see the monsters beneath. Our own near death, the possibility of disease, the possible unfriendliness of our friends, the possible prejudice of our neighbors, the possible reversal of the cycle of prosperity, and the awful possibility that we may be frittering away our time in utterly useless pursuit. These are the monsters of the deep, and these we would far prefer not to acknowledge. And so when our children or our friend asks us an embarrassing why, explain to me, rationalize for me your life, we turn against them. Don't badger me. Don't ask me these things. Isn't it enough for you that I earn my living, that I live by a basic code of responsibility and respectability? Ask no more of me. Is that enough? Is that really all that we ask of ourselves? Of course it is not. Each of us wants to do more than to earn and to eat. We want to live wisely, and we want to live well, and we want to live with some understanding of why we are living and where we are going and what is demanded of us and by whom. We want to understand life. Well then, admit life to be first off that which it is. Short, vulnerable, filled with obstacle, uncertain. Know life for what it is. When you have seen life whole, then begin to search out life's meaning. This is the second element in Mr. Hammarskjöld's philosophy. Search out, seek out the meaning of life. You cannot find philosophy as you sit quietly by your fireside. Philosophy comes to man in the living, in experience, by understanding, by living and loving and reflecting and being part of this chaotic thing we call civilization. Search out and seek for life. There is a dramatic parallel between the opening poem of The Markings and the first statement of spiritual odyssey reflected in our Bible. Let me give you first Mr. Hammarskjöld's little poem. I am being driven forward into an unknown land. The pass grows steeper, the air colder and sharper. A wind from my unknown goal stirs the strings of expectation. Still the question, shall I ever get there? There where life resounds a clear, pure note in the silence. I am being driven forward into an unknown land. When Abraham was summoned to his spiritual odyssey, God said simply to him, Lech lecha me'artzecha, me'moladecha, me'beit avicha, el ha'aretz asher areka. Get thee out of thy land, from thy father's house, from thy homeland, unto the land that I will show you. Abraham was summoned, but he was not told his ultimate direction, only el ha'aretz asher areka, unto the land that life will show you in the living. You will find your destination ultimately once you have set out in the journey. And so it is with all who seek. We must begin the journey. Begin to ask and to wonder and to puzzle and to sift the facts of life down, to seek to lay bare their ultimate skeleton. And we cannot be sure where we will end or what will be our final philosophy. Life is understood only by those who journey out into it. Philosophy can be learned only through tears and by sweat. Each of us is being drawn out into an unknown land. And that is in its own way why faith and philosophy is so difficult to come by. It cannot be handed over whole. The faith of the father cannot be the faith of the child, for the father's experience is ultimately unique, different than that of his offspring. And so we cannot have faith for the memorizing of our father's catechism. We must wrench faith and understanding out of our own life experience. Each faith is in its own essentials unique unto itself. And so too we can understand Mr. Hammarskjöld's observation that many have been driven into the outer darkness by too easy talk of faith. Many have been driven into the outer darkness by too easy talk of faith. You and I know what he means by this. Learning and reading our experience has shattered forever the once crystal clear teachings of the Sunday school. We need to know more. And we are sometimes put off by the serene confidence of the pulpit and of the prayer book. That is not our faith. Our faith knows stumblings. It knows the moment when the heavens are gray and steel shut, when we would draw close, when we cry out, and there is no answer. Ad ana Adonai tishkacheni netzach. Ad ana tastir et panecha mimeni. How long, O Lord, wilt thou forget me? Wilt thou forget me forever? For how long, O Lord, wilt thou hide thy face from me? These are not the words of alienation spoken by a modern. These are the words of the psalmist. 3,000 years ago, in the age of burning, flaming faith, yet knew those moments of alienation, of estrangement, when the congregation rose to sanctify God, holy, 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 where he stood, a stranger, the heavens closed. Faith is not a thing, it's not a solid, it's not something we can purchase and keep close by and recall at will. Faith is a search. Search for God, a search for meaning, a search for reality, a search for maturity, a search to know what is demanded of us and by whom. And as with any journey, there are days when the journey is easy and the way is sure, and there are days when we trip over ourselves and we find the path surrounded by all manner of obstacle. There are days when we walk in the sunlight, and there are days when we walk bent under the storm clouds. Ad ana Adonai tishkacheni netzach, ad ana tastir et panecha mimeni. Seek to know and set out on the search. This is the sum of the wisdom of all honest men. This is the sum of the wisdom of our people, which has never insisted that the Jew rise in his sanctuary and speak a complicated catechism beloved to some father. The elemental religious requirement is search. Darshuni v'yichyu. Seek ye me, seek ye God, and live. In the search itself is the faith. Faith begins and ends, really, in the honesty of our search. Mr. Hammarskjöld's search for faith has many parallels to our own. It is an honest book. The man, ourselves, we are recognizable in it. But there is one way in which Mr. Hammarskjöld's journey cannot be our own. Abraham was commanded to take a journey. Lech lecha me'artzecha. Get thee out from thy home. Leave off the old habits, the outworn philosophies, the outdated practices. Find a new way, a new understanding, a new and cleaner and better faith. But Abraham's journey was a geographical fact, and it was spent and taken among men. He went with his family and with his tribe, and he went from city to city. Abraham sought faith among the living. Indeed, the biblical phrase is instructive. Lech lecha me'artzecha u'mimuladetcha u'mibeit chaviha el ha'aretz asher ha'reka ve'heyeh livracha. Get thee out from thy past. Be a law in the journey, a blessing. Wherever you go, live among men, live worthily among men, bring happiness and goodness to the families of mankind. Judaism has always insisted that we will find God and goodness in the world of men. As we live in our families, as we show kindliness and gentleness and love to others, as we live by a code of justice, as we seek to establish righteousness and freedom in the community, in the world of men, there is God. Live and you shall find. Faith is to be distilled from history and from our own personal experience with life. Per contra, Mr. Hammarskjöld sought faith within himself. His is not a physical journey, but a plumbing of one's own inner depths, one's own soul. The Christian mystics used to call this a dying unto oneself. Hammarskjöld is by way of being a spiritual bachelor, a solitaire. He was a man who was afraid to reach out with the nerve endings of emotion, of feeling, of love, and to be part and near and close to. His search is rather a search to be cut off from all the noise and the cacophony and the confusion of life, to find the silence, and then to find the light within. Now, if Hammarskjöld meant only to find the silence for thought, the quiet for introspection, we would know what he meant. The longest journey, he wrote, is the inward journey. The longest journey is the inward journey of him who has chosen his destiny, who has started upon his quest for the source of his being. But the longest journey, this inward journey, is something more than the quiet, that moment of detachment which allows for reflection. It is a dying unto oneself. It is a going within, further and further down into the shadow world, into the darkness which is our soul, seeking the source of our being, seeking, our people would say, the light that is not there. Divers tell us that as they plunge into the darkness of the depths of the water, there is a fatal fascination to the depth. It draws them on. It draws them beyond their strength, beyond escape. And so I am afraid this dying unto oneself, this journey within, draws us on farther and farther into the darkness, into madness, even into suicide. Hammarskjöld came close more than once in his thought to a feeling of the inaccessible solitude of death, the beauty of death and of dying. And as one reads this little volume, one has the feeling that had it not been for the press of his official duty, affairs where he really had not the leisure to carry out the logic of his own search, he might have done away with himself. The journey, the search for faith must be with others, in the busyness of life, in our partnership with the living. Within we will find the resources with which to reason, but within we will find only the darkness, the light of life, the light of love, the light of companionship. This is the enlightenment ready for our understanding. Wisdom comes to man in the living. Lech lecha me'artzecha u'mimoladetecha u'mibeit avicha ve'yei livracha. Get thee out. Seek thee the faith sufficient. Seek it among the living. Seek it by living by the highest code of honor of which you are capable, and learning, and faith will come to you. That is the teaching of our Bible. These are the reflections I would leave with you this morning. Amen.